Hi, Spring fans. Welcome to a beautiful podcast. I'm your host, Spring Developer Advocate Josh Long, and this show is all about the real heroes behind Spring and its ecosystem.
Hey, Spring fans. Welcome to another installment of a beautiful podcast, named, of course, for my love for Spring Boot and the ecosystem that surrounds it. Today's show, of course, figures to be a fun one. I'm super excited about today's guest, Reactor Project Lead Stefan Maldini. But first, I want to engage in just a little bit of a meta discussion, if you'll indulge me. So you see, dear listeners, this show has been a success so far. A mild success, mind you, because it's just begun, but it's a success, right? We're getting lots of listeners pretty quickly. Turns out this whole enterprise Java space is a pretty interesting, packed, wild, and crazy kind of space. So always good to see that growth. I'm keen on continuing my work. I'm trying to grow this podcast. I think it's working out so well, but so far. But of course, there's more we could do. First of all, how are you liking it? You know, I always want to know. If you have feedback, don't hesitate to reach out to me at bootifulpodcast@joshlong.com. I hope I'm striking the right balance. So far, I've been sticking to just interviews with people who know stuff that I wish I knew and stuff that I wish I could share with you. And I feel like people are digging the results. But that's not to say that we can't do better. I'd like to have more segments, maybe more kinds of segments, not just more segments, but more variety in the segments, right? Maybe I could do a quick recap of the latest and greatest in the JVM and Spring ecosystem, for example, every week. Maybe we could do games, right? I mean, there's just a lot of stuff that's worth doing. I would like to get a show notes and transcripts added, to have a proper website. These things are always interesting to me, and I'd love your feedback and input on what you'd like to see, as always. One thing I do know is that if I'm going to be able to scale this out, I'll need to get faster at production. I'd like to raise money to support paying someone to do the production on each episode. The first several episodes of the podcast were recorded last year. I spent a lot of time between the recordings of the interviews and actually producing and releasing them because I was flying blind. I've never produced a podcast before. I didn't know what I didn't know. So I learned Adobe Audition. I learned about audio engineering. I learned about syndication of podcasts. I learned about podcast recording setups and different things like that. And if I'm honest, I'm still nowhere near a credible producer, but I know I can throw together an episode fairly easily, and I can draw in some part on my now creaking the old Adobe Premiere skills. These sort of they come in handy in the world of podcasting. But that said, I'm nowhere near qualified to do this, and more to the point, it's not something I want to do. Right? It's not the thing that I'm here to do. Right? I can say I'm not completely useless at the process, but I'd like to stick to the thing I find fun, and hopefully the thing that delivers the most value to you, dear listener. I want to spend as much time talking to smart people, and I'm looking to stay above the value line, the podcast value line, to borrow an idea from Pivotal legend and Senior Vice President James Waters. So I try to keep busy, right? If you know me from everything else I do, you'll know that I try to keep busy, right? I'm always working on a book or a multi-part, 10 or 9, 8 or 9 or 10 or whatever part blog series, or I do my weekly screencast called Spring Tips. These are always usually 35 minutes to an hour long, introducing a little parts of the ecosystem. Or I do my in-studio live lesson videos. These are more masterclass length introductions to topics on Safari. I do the weekly Spring update called This Week in Spring. I do a monthly blog column called This Month in Spring. So I've always got something going on, right? And I'm always trying to just keep you, my dear audience, as apprised of what's going on as possible, because I feel like I spend as much time as I can trying to keep up, and it's still overwhelming. And so the least I can do is try and condense that, to try and funnel it wherever possible. In addition to a non-trivial amount of travel, right? Every year I travel a fair bit. Last year, for example, I crossed 500,000 miles. That was my third year hitting global services on United, right? I mean, that's invitation-only tier levels of status on the airline. It's crazy if you think about it, how much travel that is, right? That means in the last 3 years, I've crossed more than 1.5 million miles, you know, just flying around the world. That's I spent more than a month and a half with my feet off of the planet, just cruising from one place to another at 500 miles an hour or more, right? I visited 30 countries last year on six different continents, right? The point is, I do get around, right? And that's in addition to everything else I do. So while I do all this, I've also got a partner and a kid. And I mention all of this because I love doing lots of things, but I don't like being busy. Being busy is demoralizing. It's not why I'm here. I want to raise money to hire help so that I can do lots of things, but not be busy, right? In order to scale, I'm going to try a few different things. The podcast has already got more than 1,000 listeners per each episode, so that's a non-trivial audience, right? That's a non-trivial base. So I'm hoping to attract advertisers, for example, who would want to appeal to that JVM enterprise-y and Spring-centric audience. It would mean I'd have some money in three episode blocks, right? I'd sell ads that would run on, let's say, three episodes, and I'd just charge some flat rate, let's say like $1,000. I'm not sure, you know, obviously what the market will bear, but I'm hoping something in that range. That would mean a couple things. If I could get people to commit to advertising for three episodes and I just get one flat rate for that, it would mean that I'd have less ads per episode, which is great for all of us because I don't want to have I don't want to do too much production in the meantime trying to figure out how to weave in those ads, first of all, and then second of all, nobody wants to listen to a thing that's just all ads. That's no fun for anybody. And also, I want advertisers who are going to be interesting to that audience. So it goes both ways. I don't want to just sell, Starbucks or something. I'm sure it's a fine thing to sell, but I'd like to have things that speak to the audience that is listening to this podcast, right? So there's a I hate to use that word, synergy there, right? And of course, the question then, of course, is what kind of ads? Well, obviously, there's two different kinds of ads these days that are popular in podcasts. One is the sort of pre-recorded, just hit play, and it's whatever you give me as audio, and I just play that. Or we have what are called native ads, and these are ads that are sort of me speaking to or speaking about a thing. Possibly, I could just read your copy, right? Your words, or perhaps read that and then speak to it in part, so that it integrates nicely with the narrative of the podcast. Whatever approach you'd prefer, I'm willing to do that. But the goal of both of these, the goal of that would be to support having a financial runway, so that things that are, so that I know I have enough money to get. And pay for help, and then to have a runway. So if I need to get busy, I can pre-produce a number of episodes, and then just not worry about it. Schedule them to trickle out once a week, every week, for in perpetuity. The other thing I want to do is set up a Patreon. A Patreon is an online platform that lets people subscribe to creators and artists. The idea is that you commit to donating a certain sum of money, and again, it doesn't need to be. A lot, or even a small amount. It could just be a couple dollars or whatever, a couple of the equivalent in your local currency, because you would do it every episode. So, at scale, that could be a non-trivial amount of money. Obviously, there isn't a paywall here, so it would be charity. It would be a donation. You'd just be helping me make it easier to get the podcast out and so on. Right now, it takes hours every week to produce the episodes, in addition to recording the interviews, right, with people, and to preparing for those shows with people. And I'm still not doing everything I'd like to do, right? There's a whole bunch of other things I'd love to do, like having transcripts and having show notes that are prepared and having links for everything and making sure that we get all the audio sound, all the noise in the recording. So all these things require just a little bit more time than I currently have. So I'm hoping that these things can work out. If you're interested in advertising, if you think that would be a good fit for you, don't hesitate to reach out to me. BOOTIFULPODCAST at joshlung.com, bootifulpodcast@joshlung.com. And if you want to support the Patreon, well, I'm going to set that up, and the link will be at the bottom of the SoundCloud page from which the podcast is syndicated. So you go to soundcloud.com, A Bootiful Podcasts, with hyphens in between. So A Bootiful Podcast, A-Bootiful-Podcast. And there you'll find a bunch of links, including my Twitter handle and the Twitter handle for the podcast, and where you can find this podcast on Google Play and iTunes, and of course the Patreon. So thanks all very much in advance for that. I hope this can be a meaningful thing for everybody. Now, let's get to today's episode. Today, as I say, I'm happy to welcome Reactor Project Lead Stefan Maldini, with whom I've had the pleasure of working since the VMware days, right? Stefan has arrived at the Spring team in a kind of roundabout way, always doing these very interesting things off to the side, sort of Spring adjacent, and yet arguably what he is doing now in the Reactor team is of significant import to the larger Spring team and Spring ecosystem. Indeed, I spend my every waking day these days talking to developers about reactive programming, right? And this wouldn't be possible but for the work that Stefan has contributed to the projects and the ecosystem that he's inspired, galvanized, right? So I was very excited to get to talk with him. Stefan actually lives now in the Bay Area, and we hang out, and I've always enjoyed going out to you know, have a dinner or go hang out with him in other places that he's lived. So he lived for a long time in the UK, for example, right? So he's actually one of those people where I could spend whole evenings and not talk about tech and still have a great time. Really, really love talking to Stefan. So I hope that you enjoy the episode and that you learn something. It's always good to pry him away from the code, because I know he's got so much going on, and that work is, you know, growing apace these days, becoming more and more significant. So it was my pleasure to talk to him, and I hope you enjoy the show. How are you, Stefan?
I'm doing great, thank you. How are you doing?
Good, man. Was that an okay description of you, of your sort of
title?
Yeah, title, you know, position in the world, etc.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm the lead engineer for Project Reactor at Pivotal, and yeah, I do all kind of reactive work within the company, specifically in the Spring team. So yeah, kind of my reactive hat, you know, Andy man, trying to help everywhere we think about reactive stuff.
Right on. Okay. The reactive stuff is becoming more important these days, I notice. So while that title is interesting and it carries a lot of weight, I would say it's more interesting today in 2019 than it was, for example, when you first started back in 2004. When did you start on Reactor?
It was back in 2013, I think, maybe before that. So 2012. It's not a new project, actually, and all of these things, in fact, aren't really, really new. But yeah, it's. I joined the company in 2012. At the time, it was still Spring Source, a VMware, and then we created this wonderful company, Pivotal, in 2013, and I transitioned over.
Mm-hmm. I remember that. Yeah. The the project, I think a lot of people would be surprised to know that there's been Reactor in Spring since at least Spring Framework 4, right? Not 5, 4, you know,
yes.
under the WebSocket support, you know? So what's the story there? I remember Reactor looks very different today, to my mind, than it did when we first started talking about it, right? I mean, the evolution of Reactor. I remember we started 2011, and then John Brisbin had his thing, and then we had Tim Fox and Node.x, and there was that sort of, you know, co-evolution at the same time. We had two different reactive projects at VMware. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do remember very much that.
And they're both, you know, we were trying to help each other at some point, and sometimes that didn't work as well as we'd hoped, but at least there's progress. And eventually the Node.x thing got renamed into Vert.x, and we donated it to the Eclipse Foundation. And then I think that really gave Reactor time to breathe. It gave us room to breathe and room to like focus on, you know, we weren't competing. We were just trying to evolve the best thing that we could evolve and do so in a way that fit, I think, the use cases that our customers were starting to give to us.
Yeah, that's interesting. You actually remember precisely this story. I mean, it's been a long time. But yeah, I don't think a lot of people around know that Vertex and Reactor were kind of the same vision or project at the time, and then one evolved to this Node.x story that became Vertex after, and then we had Reactor, which at the time was really focusing on the story. Yeah, the story of dispatching events. Wasn't trying to create a runtime yet, like Vertex was creating a full stack framework. We were trying to create a kind of very efficient dispatcher, and we were inspired by mechanical sympathy and the ring buffer, the disruptor pattern from Mark Thompson, and
that whole thing, like we don't talk about the ring buffer stuff anymore. We don't talk about the disruptor anymore, because that, you know, now it's a very different story. When did things change? Can you tell, like, people might remember that.
So we went from, so that was basically the story of Reactor 1, this dispatching story. And then in Reactor 2, by the time, I think it was late 2013, we were contacted by TypeSafe at the time, and Netflix folks, Ben Christensen in particular, to work on a new specification, which was and still named Reactive Streams.
Right.
And that changed our whole perception about how we deal with asynchronous data computing and sequences.
Right.
It made things simpler, and we worked a lot, specifically with Ben. We were really inspired by, at the time, the reactive extensions. You know, the project was at the origin this thing from RX.NET, Microsoft RX.NET. It took so much amplitude and was successful. A lot of people started understanding complex concurrency patterns with this thing, and we were really inspired by that. And reactive streams try to extract some of this information as other information, and was inspired by also the Reactive Manifesto from TypeSafe.
Right.
And for Reactor 2, we made that shift at this moment when the Reactive Stream specification was moving forward, and we were still, you know, working on the specification and TCK. We wanted to be one of the first implementer of the specification. So we use Reactor 2 as kind of transition to this reactive streams pattern.
Yeah.
That was the first time we actually had a library around reactive streams.
That was Reactor 2, right?
Yeah. And that was Reactor 2 indeed.
What year was that?
I think it was around 2014, because the specification is probably going to be was released around this date, and we tried to match the release date of the specification, the 1.0 of Reactive Streams specification.
And we also needed a GA for Did we do that after Spring Framework 4 or before? Because we had Reactor support for WebSockets in Spring Framework 4. And I remember we needed Spring Framework 4 before we could ship Spring Boot 1, which was April of 2014 or so.
I think it was around the same date.
Right.
So that was then, yeah, working on Reactor 2. And we had to rush a few things then to fit in the timeline as well.
So
and
we had stream support in Spring Framework 4?
No, directly. It was quite hidden. And in fact, in Reactor 2, the reactive stream support wasn't core. So we had, like now, a Reactor core, but Reactor core was really still about this contract around dispatching. And then the work around reactive streams was isolated in a different jar we called Reactor streams. And Spring didn't depend on that. They just directly depended on core and the network package we have. We had at the time Reactor Net, and they needed that, and that was enough. So nothing related to reactive streams yet.
What could have been.
Yeah, could have been. But I think, you know, as you said, the timeline was pretty close, April. Yeah. And I think the specification was also going to be released around these dates, or not too far.
Right. So, it's weird. I talk to people out in the road, and I talk to them about how, we've got this reactive support. It's 2019, and we're talking about reactive programming. We're talking about all this cool stuff, and people think it's a brand new feature. And I have to explain, no. You know, Microsoft is doing ARX extensions, the reactive extensions for .NET. You know, what, 2010? I mean, and then eventually. Mm-hmm. You had RX Java from Netflix, which was the Ben Christensen's thing, and it's been almost a decade since I think the major players in the community have been talking about this stuff, and I think it's been driven by microservices and big data, right? You've got more I/O, you've got more input and output happening, and suddenly it's inefficient to scale up and have more threads, right? Suddenly we have
exactly you pinpoint the right thing here. I don't want to burn steps right now, but that's exactly what made all of us in the Spring team to really consider reactive streams at some point, especially for Spring Framework right. 5. That's the explosion of microservices.
Yeah, and it's really big data, right? You also have these giant streams of data. We have data that goes on for a long time. You have sensor networks, IoT, all these things that require more input and output, mm-hmm. I just think it's sort of interesting because I think the Spring team, we took a very interesting approach. We said that, okay, if you take your old applications and decompose them into microservices, right? Small, singly focused microservices, mm-hmm. and you build them in this 12-factor style where you remove state as much as possible so that it's stateless and there's as little I/O as possible. And if you do have state, you move it to the database tier, which hopefully is using asynchronous I/O. It's using fast input and output to be efficient, right? So it's not blocking threads wherever possible. And that strategy of like scaling out to 12-factor, scaling out to microservices, refactoring to these paradigms, that strategy meant that people now had small applications that they could buy app instances for, right? You could go to Amazon or Cloud Foundry or whatever and scale out. So that way, even though you're still using a servlet-based application, which is inefficient because it's going to block, you can get more users per second just by scaling horizontally, right? And I think that was a great like halfway step. You know, it's a half step. It's between the old world of the monolith and between the new world of the reactive cloud native application, you know, where everything is as efficient as possible, you know? But that does feel a little bit like it feels like somebody, it feels like we sold a car that we know can fly, but we didn't tell people it could fly yet. You know, we just sold them a regular car.
And I think it's totally fine because you don't transform industries to a totally different paradigm like that. I mean, you need sometimes to transition teams. People need to adopt this new mindset as well. Developers and also all the teams working around application developments like OPS, security, etc. It's a whole class of problems you're dealing with. And, you know, if we wanted to do all in and change to the perfect architecture since the, day one for any enterprise who adopts microservice cloud native architecture. Mm-hmm. That wouldn't be as successful as it is right now. We needed a smoother transition, in my opinion. That's great. I think the path is more than correct.
Oh, as do I. The Big Bang migration was hard enough without having to introduce Reactive. But I like now with Reactive, we're asking people to make a major change, right? And mm-hmm. I think a big part of that was to move the developer as far away from the limitations of synchronous and blocking I/O as possible. And so, for example, when you're using Spring Boot, you don't know that there's a servlet engine there, right? You're using Spring MVC annotations and you've got a component model. And unless you're really doing something strange where you're creating servlet registration beans or filter registration beans, unless you're doing something very specific, it's entirely possible to build an application that goes from development all the way to production and never touches any servlet API, right? And I think that was very useful because now, you know, you, with some very small changes, you can take that existing application and move it to Spring Web Flux, and it'll still be blocking I/O, but now it's easy enough to say, okay, well, I'm not using the servlet API, so all I got to do now is bring in Reactive as opposed to throwing out servlet, right? I'm not trying to get rid of something. I'm just trying to bring in Reactive where appropriate, right? And so you start changing your data layer to use publishers. You start talking to services using the Reactive web client. You know, these things become opt-in as opposed to opt-out, you know?
Yeah, and that's really the powerful message the Spring team has tried to shape for Spring Framework 5. Being able to reuse a maximum of years of accumulated knowledge from Spring developers and the community outside and provide them with an extra opt-in. Do they want to explore for some use cases? And there are some interesting ones, obviously, for us. Some use cases you want to add the Reactive flavor to your application. You reuse the same. We have created the same convention. We have reused the same conventions, so we don't lose our community too much. They just focus on the new Reactive mindset, and right. I think that really is a major difference and even inspiring difference nowadays in the Reactive sort of framework market or mindshare. It seems like we don't try to force the hand of the developer, and that's the big message here. We still support MVC. We still support all the container people mm-hmm. know and have approved for years, and we have a message around that. We know when you want to keep that, and we also provide the full option without any kind of constraint. Like, we're not trying to put some lipstick and add a bridge or an adapter. If you move to Webflux, you're really moving to a Reactive foundation and full stack Reactive library. So it's really powerful. The power of conventions, with decades of Spring development with many, many smart people there working on these conventions. That's really interesting.
I like how in this case, it's not possible to go from Spring MVC, You can't take full advantage of Reactive without changes to the code, right? There's going to be some compilation changes at some point, right? When you introduce publisher and all that, that's not the same as not having a publisher, right? But
sort of. You can still do things without even changing the signature type. Like, you can still, in the controller return a user, whether you are in a MVC or a Webflux application, it still works.
Yeah, of course. Your existing stuff works, but in order to take advantage of Reactive, in order to be able to get, for example, if you want to do service and events, for example, you'd have to return a publisher. Mm-hmm. But that's okay because the only thing that a developer has to learn is this very small sort of, this idea of what a publisher is, as opposed to learning a completely different framework. You still are working in something that looks very similar to Spring MVC. Right, you make changes here and there to embrace, to support, to add in this new Reactive support. So we're not promising that it'll be a drop-in replacement, and you'll get suddenly you're suddenly your code is as efficient as possible, right? But it is nice that the journey to reactive is a small one, whereas before, if you're using Spring MVC and you wanted to use reactive, you could throw all your code away and go to Vertex, I guess, or try and use Akka. I mean, those are nice technologies, but there's nothing there that's familiar for the Spring developer. So I think it was really, really smart, for the Spring team to have taken this very sort of gradual, incremented approach and introduced the minimal of breaking changes.
Yeah, I think progressive enhancement is really a big thing in general in the Spring framework and the Spring community. So it made sense. It still makes sense today to have this flavor, this opt-in flavor.
So was there ever a discussion of having the web component be a Reactor module as opposed to something in Spring? Like, why wasn't there, did you ever think of just going to be, of Reactor becoming more like Vertex and becoming its own little framework? Or at what point did we say, okay, Reactor will stay a very core heart library, a library at the core of, at the heart of Spring, but Spring will build upon that and that'll be the surface component model?
Yes, that's a good question. So exactly that's when we touched on, we started creating Reactor Free as it is right now. A small library, a kind of Rx Java Lite, because we still have less types and we try to maintain a smaller surface API, focusing on Java 8 and reactive streams. And the decision was to separate the concurrency concerns and solving all this, composition problem in a different library. Same for bridging to Nedi, for instance, the library we use for our HTTP and TCP server client, to the reactive streams world. Keep that separate in Reactor, but build on top of that the programming, the developer experience. I think it's still today possible to use, especially Reactor Core, everywhere you can. Some driver will use it directly, like RabbitMQ, as adapters to use directly Reactor, a bit like what we find with Rx Java, basically. Some driver, database drivers, etc., will use Reactor directly. But for Reactor Nedi, it's a complex problem on its own to solve the bridge between network and reactive streams. It's interesting to have it separate. You can build build an application only with Reactor Nedi, but the problem is you will miss all the smart things Spring has been doing for years, like headers introspection, content type negotiation, filtering, security
injection.
Yeah, all of this stuff which already exists. Right. Why are will we be competing with that? And if that's a space we want to provide this developer experience, we should just continue building on that. User already understand that. Spring is massively successful, even more with Spring Boot. And we want to capitalize and build this developer experience here. But we don't want to prevent, if someone wants to say, I don't need to use Spring, I'm a driver, so I'm very low level, I can't really afford depending on a container, or I don't need annotation. I know exactly what I need to do. We provide the low level bricks, and you build yourself your driver or your components based on that. We like the separation. So low level direct access to the things we provide, and or use the full developer experience from Spring.
Right. And I noticed that you said drivers do pull it in, but there's also a kind of a small ecosystem of, not even small anymore, it's actually, you mentioned RabbitMQ, there's a driver now based on Reactor. We have a Kafka module, for example. You mentioned the Nedi module. So all of that stuff integrates core reactive stream types in terms of Reactor.
Because that's very important to think that the Reactor Core, the types will leak, because that's the main type as a developer you will learn to work with. You will see Flux and Mono, the publisher implementation, the Reactor Core support. You will see that, and you will need to learn over time more and more of this operation and patterns around these types. They will be you know, like future, computable future, there will be types you will need to work with. And we have that with, we provide facilities for drivers and other libraries and Spring itself to avoid creating the same operation every time and just use the facilities available in Reactor Core. And not only Pivotal provides these libraries, but also outside of Pivotal, you will find Salesforce, gRPC, Reactive Driver using Reactor, for instance, or Lettuce, the Redis driver. These kind of initiatives are very interesting.
Yeah, there's RSocket, there's Assembler, there's the Kafka module, there's we got gRPC, the Salesforce Protoc compiler plugin for gRPC. You've got Redis, you said? Yeah, there's that. Yeah, I mean, Redis. There's something else that I was trying to remember. Oh, well, a bunch of things are using reactive types. You mentioned the surface area types, and I thought that was kind of an interesting discussion. When you look at RxJava, there's like six different core types, whereas we've only got two. We've got a reactive single value, mono, or, you know, zero or one, and you've got a reactive stream of values, which is flux, whereas in RxJava, you have a single and observable and some that are a flowable, and you know there's other ones that don't have reactive back pressure semantics. Mm-hmm. They're streams of asynchronous values that don't have back pressure. And I was wondering, did we ever think about having that more subtle breakdown? Because I actually quite like the idea that we've just got two types, but I wonder if there are situations for which we might need a third type or one of those other types from RxJava. Why did they introduce those and when we didn't? What was
So that's a good question. And first thing first, we RxJava 2 and Reactor 3 came at the same time from the same project with the same people behind. So David Carnock and I collaborated on this project called Reactive Stream Commons to create the common foundation for these two libraries. It wasn't even sure, in fact, RxJava 2 was going to come out until a certain time, and it was a few months after Reactor 3 was out, we actually got RxJava 2. The problem with RxJava was it suffers from the huge success, the huge legacy impact it has, and it cannot throw away things like we had a complete reset with Reactor 3, which upset a few person, you know, reset. Yeah, we resetted the expectations and we created a kind of a new library. We should have even given a new name instead of calling it Reactor 3. Sometimes I think about that.
Yeah.
But we had this freedom because we don't have a huge legacy. We had specific niche of community niche we were talking to. And yes, we pay that price of changing our core library, but RxJava has all these libraries in integrating with it, and they cannot throw away things like observable. And in fact, observable wasn't meant to have back pressure. It was implemented in RxJava 1, but a certain portion of the Rx community didn't want to have that because Rx.net didn't introduce back pressure to observable. In fact, Eric Mayer didn't want to have back pressure on these types. They were meant to be asynchronous sequence. You don't have any control on whether you stop the event coming to the sequence or not. That's the back pressure.
I didn't realize
and
that.
They were meant to, because they were serving a very mixed range of, and they're still serving a very mixed range of use cases, including UI. And you don't stop events coming from UI like that. I mean, you can apply back pressure to a user clicking his mouse 10,000 times. You have to act on that by using these Rx operators like a sampling operator and all this stuff, debouncing, etc., to filter the number of events. So in this case, that's right. Back pressure doesn't make sense. You cannot, you know, act on this information. So that's the approach they have. So really, it was a conflict for RxJava to keep that. And I don't want to create the full history. David Carnock would be the right person to talk to about this, but is I think it was in the opinion of having something more like, React or something with a more limited number of types. We had the choice to do that, and that's pretty great. We did it. And for the case of Arex, they have to maintain all these types. I'm not sure if it's going to change or not in Arex Java 3. We will need to see. But at the same time, you have to remember that Arex Java 2 supports Java 6 as well. So right. That means they don't necessarily have access to stream. And for us in Reactor, it's easy to say, okay, we don't need a known back pressure type because we are minimum Java 8 requirement. Right. And that means if you can use stream, basically. If you don't want back pressure, you can just use something like stream and use that as something which pull everything or nothing. And that's right. That would work. We don't need to create... Well, there could have been interesting operation on top of that, like the timed operation. But we didn't want to invest too much into that because we already have the types we need with Flux and Mono. That's the focus, just implementing reactive streams and that's it. That's an interesting difference between the two libraries. Nowadays, we still time to time synchronize on the issues because we still, have a strong dependency on the same pattern between Arex Java and us. So we talk between us with David time to time, or we look at each other repositories and commits and sometimes file issues directly. And you can see David was actually still listed as maintainer of and founder of the Reactor 3 library, is still replying on some issues on all sides. Sometimes every now and then we will do the same thing in the Arex Java repository. So that's pretty cool. And I think one important number I've learned, I can't remember exactly what I've seen that, but when I discussed, I think, with David, I understood that Arex Java user audience was 70% plus. Android user base, and that's totally fine with us, because we don't really target Android, given that we need Java 8. Not every Android device has Java 8 yet. So I think the split is interesting. Some users already have noticed that Java 8 and reactive streams focus is something important enough to make a decision between choosing Arex Java or Reactor. And also, right. Obviously, if you use Spring, you can use Reactor because it's already there if you use the Webflux stack, and that's cool. But you are very welcome to use Arex Java as well if you want to keep consistent, for instance, between your Android code and your backend code, and you want to use Arex Java in both sides. Spring will do the work to convert between Reactor and Arex Java, which is very little work because both, unless you implement Observable, both implement Publisher, so Reactive Streams library.
Yeah, you're just taking one publisher and adapting it into another, right? And there's mono.from and flux.from, etc.
Yeah, and we go even beyond that because we recognize that it has been a decade already, or it was close to a decade when we created Reactor 3 and Reactive Stream Commons. We recognize the naming conventions provided by Reactive Extension kind of became an industrial standards in the field. And we try to have the same naming conventions. Sometimes we tweak because we like consistency as well in the API. So we will do some tweaks to make things easier to discover. A functional API is kind of overwhelming when you look at it at first. So we try to apply some simple tweaks in terms of naming with prefix to make it easier to discover when you arrive and you look at this flux or monotype for the first time. But more or less, you will see map, flat map, this interesting keyword resonating, and at some point when you compose a flux or an observable or a flowable, if you don't have access to the original type in the signature or somewhere, it does kind of lose its importance because it feels the same, feels so much the same that you're not lost transitioning between the two libraries. You can port your knowledge from Rx to Reactor and the opposite side.
Right, which is awesome. Yeah, I love that you have that interoperability, and I think that's a big part of the success of the Reactive Stream spec itself is just having that interoperability. So Rx Java and Reactor both build upon the Reactive Streams types. That is, the types are surfaced as part of the surface area API. Whereas I noticed Vertex and Akka Streams, for example, they can produce instances of types that are compatible with that are publishers, but by default you're not dealing with publishers. And I wonder, what do you think of that design versus what we did, and which one? What does it mean for interoperability in the future when we talk about Java 9, Java Util, Concurrent Flow, dot publisher, dot subscriber, etc.?
So I think the design we adopted with Rx is to produce a publisher at every stage. So
right.
That's interesting when you, especially if you take something like Spring and you start using signature arguments. With publisher as an argument type, it's pretty interesting that you can pass a flux, and if you do dot map, you can still pass it because it still returns a publisher, et cetera, because at every stage we stay publisher and we implement this back pressure at every stage, the contract of reactive streams at every stage, which is interesting, but it required a bit of kind of imagination, and we still sometimes get around the specification for optimization reason. Mm-hmm. That's what we have called operator fusion. So we will try to sometimes bypass the overhead of using the protocol of reactive streams by doing some kind of short circuit calls inside our internals. We detect when we can do that, and we apply this optimization where we can. So there is a cost in doing that, and we try to do it well.
Right.
In Akka Streams, I guess Akka Streams is different from Vertex. Akka Streams will still be a library, a low-level library you can use to compose anything like Rx and Reactor. And they will produce at the end the reactive streams type, but they don't need to obey this reactive stream specification at every stage, and that provide them probably more interesting options as well in terms of optimization and what they can do internally, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a fine approach, and I don't really have anything specific, against that, except that I really like on our side and Rx Java side, I really like the fact that every stage is a reactive streams stage, basically, where the Akka Streams approach will be to materialize the full flow at the end. And that provides different kind of option and optimization. But, that's just a different pattern. I'm used to comprehend now this asynchronous sequence with reactive streams and Rx Java and Reactor. And that's, I guess, what I'm used to. But
you have to materialize. Let's say that I think we are in some ways in the same situation as Akka Streams. Akka Streams, they have their own run. They have their own material representation of the flow.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the very end, you can ask the framework, the runtime, to materialize a publisher, right? But it doesn't do that by default. It's not. You can do the entire flow in Akka Streams without ever touching a publisher if you want, right? It's just that for interoperability, you can have a source that is a publisher and you can produce a publisher, right? Now we have Java Util Concurrent Flow in Java 9.
Mm-hmm.
Will we do that? Will we be able to say we're going to keep our entire runtime in terms of reactive streams publisher, but we can materialize a Java 9 publisher and accept a Java 9 publisher? Like, I don't know what does that story look like for us? Or are we going to refactor everything so that one day org.reactivestreams.publisher just disappears from Spring and from Reactor and it'll just be Java 9?
So I think that's a decision that will happen probably around Spring Framework 6 and when we decide to change the minimum Java version for Spring Framework. As of now, very little library depend on Java 9, Java Util Flow, Concurrent Java util concurrent flow. And that's fine. I mean, the specification is a jar with four interfaces in that jar, and everyone depends on that. And that's the overwhelming winning component. We bridge easily. Spring doesn't really see a problem. In fact, you don't see a problem with Spring, in fact, because again, you know, if you use convention and you use introspection of thick nature, and your controller suddenly returns flow.publisher instead of a publisher, Spring will adapt. And we provide these default adapters. In fact, in Reactor Core, no extra jar required. It's just like you use it only if you are on the Java 9 minimum runtime, because otherwise it will be class not found exception.
So that's there right now, right? Okay.
Yeah, that's right now. And cool. In the future, we might change the default we use, but everything around use the other package. The Reactive Stream package. So the thing to remember as well is the TCK is public with Reactive Streams. It's easy to use. It's not as easy to there is no official TCK with the Java one. So the Java UTL one. So it's even easier to create your own reactive library based on Reactive Streams if you start from Reactive Streams and not directly from Java UTL concurrent flow.
Right.
And the other thing is, it's just a package name change. It's annoying in terms of binary compatibility. At some point, you know, in a certain future, Spring Framework will be able to depend on that.
Yeah.
But
well, it's a package name
change.
It's a package change. A package change and a static type. We have to do an import from flow.asterisk, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but still, for instance, if you take something like Flux and we decide that Reactor 4 depend on that, you still use Flux and you don't even see that, you know, we change the implementation, basically. Oh, the interface we use. Everything is the same. The naming then, on next, on error, on complete, this method defined.
One thing that might solve the problem is if one day the Reactive Stream stuff ever implemented Java util types, right? That would actually, it would be silly, but that way suddenly all the code that's all, because right now our advice is our code should return a flux or mono. Like if you return a method, return a value from a method, it should be a flux or mono, but you should accept a org Reactive Streams publisher, right? So you'd be broad in what you accept and very specific in what you return. And of course, all those things that accept publisher will now break. So if we change it so that one day in 5 years or whatever, when Java 9 is more entrenched, that org Reactive Streams publisher now implements Java util concurrent flow publisher. I don't know. These are not issues. Nobody is having this problem right now, right? I know that and you know that. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering what this means in the future, and I know we've thought about it. I'm just wondering what the position will be. Obviously, because most of our users are using Reactor, right? So they're not. Maybe
the
maybe
question for the moment. I think as it's not a problem really.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Now right now we have you're working on actively. You're leading. The Reactor project, and you've got these modules. So one thing I'm kind of curious about is what's the state right now of the Kafka support?
Huh. So it's community maintained right now. We haven't assigned internal resources, internal developers to it directly because we're pretty stretched in many, many, many other projects.
Yeah,
but the state of the Kafka support is pretty nice. We know there are a few companies around using it in production. It seems to work nicely for them. The thing is, we don't have time to give him more love to provide extra new features, and you know, it's we just rely on the community contribution there. And yeah, somehow it's unfortunate, but we have to pick battles and. We have a few to
know. Right now, one of the things I see that's very interesting about Reactor is that R2DBC, right? We've got R2DBC, which is the SQL-based data store access, you know, implemented. The SPI is publishers, but the implementations of the drivers are all Reactor. So you are no doubt involved in that, right? And then we have RSocket, right? Which I think is this very interesting project from Facebook, which has now become sort of this thing that I know Alibaba, for example, are going to embrace. And, and that's all Reactor, right? All that is, all these things are.
There's satellite projects around us, but RSocket, for instance, in itself, is a dedicated entity and project. It's a bit like Reactive Streams. It's not yet in a foundation, but there are a kind of agreement between CLA between the companies contributing to this project. And also, it's not only Java, but there are other languages it supports. So it's pretty cool.
Are there other languages besides Java?
Yeah, I know. It's scary. There is a whole world out there of things. And
I'll be ready here. You can take my Java over my cold, dead hands. You're kind of, I know you've helped with that, and then that, I think those projects feed back into Reactor. And then also, I almost forgot, the Cloud Foundry Java client, which is just this incredibly useful library led by Ben Hale, who's also involved in a lot of the things I just mentioned, right? He's involved in RSocket and involved in R2DBC.
Yeah, our relationship with Ben is pretty interesting. Is when I worked on Reactor 3 a few years ago, I was still based in London. Since then, I moved to San Francisco, but I was basically working every night to be sure I was in sync with him in San Francisco to work on this new API, Mono and Flux, based on this very real-world use case, Cloud Foundry Java library, which is his project. And it made sense because Cloud Foundry Java library is something to access and control your cloud instances running on Cloud Foundry. And these operations take time. And one thing Reactive Streams does well is making sure that things that take time don't impact your application in a negative way. And that's really an important thing. It makes the time something virtual, basically, because with Reactive Streams and the operation we provide in Reactor, you just keep adding continuation. When something is done, do this thing. And when this thing is done, do this thing. So when you reason about concurrency like that, the time it takes doesn't make sense. And that's a whole thing about, you know, non-blocking programming in general. So for his use case, it makes sense. And he has a pretty sharp eye on API. So we had this round trip between the US and London to work on the API, refine things, etc. And it worked well for his use case. It's still working. In fact, it's even, in my opinion, inspiring a few projects around because we used a lot of good kind of best practices we could use in terms of implementing a Reactive Stream library. Even I think there are talks about he gave a talk in Spring One, I can't remember which year, about how do you implement a Reactive API. Find that on YouTube. And that's pretty good. He's pretty good at explaining things as well. So I recommend searching for this link. It's so that's cool. In fact, you see today all the project. So I work with Microsoft, for instance, and they have this Azure SDK, which is also using Reactive stuff now. And they have chosen Reactor. And you can see that on GitHub. And so same thing. It's going to be a library like Cloud Foundry Java client, but this time directly accessing the Azure controller, whatever, however they call that in Azure, the API basically in a reactive way. I see there is the same thing on Amazon side as well with AWS SDK. You have a bridge to use Reactor as well, but they made a core library to be Reactive Streams compliant. So it's easy to bridge it to Reactor. They have a bridge for RxJava 2 as well.
Right.
So what we did with Ben is actually something we can see more and more, even for the inspiring, driver or library for cloud. It's pretty interesting.
Very interesting. And I, I, I feel like you just mentioned time, right? You mentioned this idea that time is that reactive programming makes time a virtual concern, and I think that's was super well put, because in Reactor, you've got this idea of the scheduler, right? I noticed there are two things with which developers need to wrestle when they write SIFT software. The fact that they don't just means that the tools aren't giving them the mechanism to address them, but it doesn't mean that the problem isn't there. The first thing that they need to address is error handling, right? This is as we move to network I/O, as we move to distributed systems, there are going to be errors. And any framework that lets you pretend that there are no errors, that lies to you about whether something is a reliably made call over the network, I think is doing a bit of a disservice. And so with reactive streams, errors are part of the spec, right? You have on error in the subscriber. So
yeah, it's important to be part of the specification, because what happens right now, especially in the Java world, is you declare all this signature or not with a throw exception, and you let this exception bubble. And you know, when you raise the exception, you lose your control of the error flow. Obviously, you can still do try catch in the user code, but then at some point, the runtime get the exception, and it's basically if the runtime it's a runtime responsibility to do something about it. Otherwise, it will kill the thread. The code is actually running, and you don't want to do that. You want to keep that control and treat the error as another kind of signal you want to do, you want to act on. That's how you create resiliency, another very important trait in reactive flows. And, you know, you see that in Reactive Manifesto as well.
Right. And I've heard it said that one of the things that Java got wrong was that it treats errors as exceptions, right? This idea that they're exceptional or special, when in fact, I think if we're honest about it, in the world of building distributed client server apps, errors are not exceptional. They will happen, and we just need to build software to handle that. So the fact that these are now top level concepts, I think, is very useful. And then the other thing is that when you use Reactor, you have a scheduler, right? You have a way to model time as part of a dimension. It's a dimension of your API, you know? And that's very interesting. And the fact that we can unit test reactive code and mock out the scheduler, you know, you have a virtual scheduler, is, you know, super interesting. It's there. Time is something you have to worry about, just like errors. But there's a nice, clean way to think about it, and it's built into the system. So it makes more effective systems.
That's something we can credit the reactive extension guys for inventing this interesting concept of scheduler, because that's... that's one of the things we directly ported from the library we created with David Carnock, the Reactive Stream Commons. And we built on top some interesting API for testing purpose. You mentioned it, virtual time scheduler and step verifier to verify in an expectation-oriented way things that happen in your flow. And when you have things that flow with timeout, for instance, because you access a remote resource, you might give a timeout and you will have this error if something doesn't happen given a certain timeout, or you have a fallback. Do you want all your unit tests to wait for this exact time to actually test this error flow? What happens when the timeout occurs? Or do you just want to trigger immediately this error so you make sure you test all your branches without paying the price of time? And that's really powerful, because this expectation-based component, step verifier, will give you the ability to define how many time you want to wait. And this time is not going to be a real-world time. You're going to travel in the future inside your test. You will make the scheduler travel in the future and move the time forward when the expectation of the time moving forward is red. So... immediately, if you have a timeout of 2 seconds and you say, I'm expecting to wait 2 seconds, just immediately the 2 seconds are elapsed, and every task which I've been registered to happen 2 seconds later will be executed just like now. And that's great, because then the difference is your unit test and CI is run within, you know, minutes instead of tens of minutes, you know,
or whatever,
or worse, you know.
Right.
So it's important, because we live in a world of fast feedback, and we need to have the CI every time telling you if something is wrong or not, and your test You don't want even to rely on a CI to run all of these tests. That takes time. The more you can run on your machine, the better, because you have a faster feedback loop to fix things. And that's important. You know, it's also a part of Spring philosophy in general, you know, improving developer productivity.
And testing. We support testing at every layer, which I think is a great message. So here we are, 2019. You and I have been friends for, you know, since you joined, basically. And now you actually, you and I live in the same city. So I always love when we get to hang out. It's kind of, it's kind of amazing to watch your journey. I've known you forever. You're French, but then you lived in London for what?
Half a year. Yeah.
5 years? Four years?
Five.
So you lived there for 5 years. And then at least a couple of years ago, you moved here to the Bay Area. I still sometimes, I think I see you more often in other cities and other conferences, because we're both never, you know, it's very hard for us to both be home. So that's interesting. But I mean, when you look back at your journey and look at where we are now, like, you know, how did you get into, first of all, programming, and then how did you get into like the Spring team? And at one point you were working on that telco system. I watched that journey from thinking about it from there to here, connecting these two things. You were working with Dassault, is that true?
No, not at the time. If you remember Stuart Williams?
Of course, Pidster on Twitter.
Pidster on Twitter, yeah. I worked with him. But I think I always liked event-driven systems. And that's since my university days in 2008, 2007, etc. And my first approach to that, and you might laugh or not, was to use JSF and iSpaces at the time. I was fascinated by the fact that a browser could, without you touching anything, could show many things, interact with you from a server side. The server side push, at the time, we call that CommitD and all these techniques. That was so interesting, but so inefficient at the time. Like, you will have 100 users, you will kill your server. That was crazy interesting. But I was always, since then, I was always into this event-driven approach for everything else. And I contributed a bit in the Grails community at the time. So I had this project called Event Bus. So created this kind of event bus pattern. So subscribe and publish subscribe pattern and provide that to the Grails community. I find this that was very interesting as well, to shape my mind around how we do these things well. That was the beginning of 2010s, and then I joined Spring Source at the time in London to do field and consulting all around. So not only I did some Spring, but I also did Gemfire and RabbitMQ. And I love these two technologies because, again, they really match with what I like in the tech world, which is being event-driven, having this stimulus. Gemfire, event-driven database to me. RabbitMQ, obviously, event-driven. I learned a lot with the team I was working with, especially Stuart Williams. Prop to him. He mentored me quite a lot. And he supported my French accent, which I assure you was much worse than what it is right now as you listen. And we learned a lot together, and we had this, that's why we also worked on Reactor together.
Right.
We had this telco customer, which had this huge need of ingesting billions of data. Basically, every event your cell phone could generate, imagine that multiplied by the number of subscribers to a network. And that's where we used Reactor in the first real, you know, real world prod use case. I learned a lot from there, from this system at scale, and how going to this reactive patterns could help or not. I think Stuart Williams actually has given in InfoQ and Spring One a couple talks about that, how to scale to 1 billion data. a second or something like that. It was a pretty crazy title. But he has some of these interesting patents we worked on together, presented
here. And that informed your sort of pursuit when you came to the reactor project, huh?
Yes, that's exactly at the same time, you know, I fed, that was the feedback loop. This project, which was then a product we called Real-Time Intelligence, a pivotal RTI, which was then an EMC project, a very successful commercial project in itself, but Pivotal pursued this cloud journey. So it was a project that finished in EMC lens at the end of the day. And the, a full, you know, kind of business was built on top of that. And pretty cool.
Very successful. I remember it being very, very, very one of those things where it's just like, I can't believe that this kind of stuff is coming out of just regular open source components and smart engineers like yourself and Stuart. I've really enjoyed kind of revisiting some of the stuff, and I learned a lot with by talking to you today. As always, I really appreciate you being able to make the time to hang out and talk to us. For our listeners, how can people find you? Are you on the internet? Are you on Twitter? Do you have an email? And what website should they check out? What's the thing that you want them to see in your work?
Unfortunately, I don't have a Medium or something like that. I don't blog. I have a Twitter handle, S Maldini. You will find me on Twitter.
And S-M-A-L-D-I-N-I.
And the site I will advertise is probably the site for the project, projectreactor.io. And you will find the latest project information, documentations, and guides and these kind of things. Recommend visiting that if you're new to reactive stuff in general and you want to learn more about Reactor. It's an interesting site.
And the documentation is amazing. Great marble diagrams, etc.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. They are, by the way, they have been converted lately. Not in the release train, we just released this week, Californium SR5, and a quick quick ad for that. If you are not there on that yet, please upgrade. There are a bunch of fixes, and you can see the on each GitHub pages every time we list the changes and fixes we have for each release. So Californium is the release train, and it's encapsulating new update for Reactor Core, which is now 3.2.6, Reactor Nitty, which is now 0.8.5. And every time you will find release notes and things for each of these projects. So, you can find interesting documentation. And one thing we did change early on this year, or maybe end of last year, is now the marble diagram, this nice diagram explaining the behavior of each operation, each functional operation you see in Flux or Mono, like map, zip, etc. They are now SVG, and they have been reworked, and they're nicer than ever. And because they are SVG, and you're welcome to reuse them in any kind of your presentation, you can just check them out. They're pretty, pretty nice. A prop to Simon and a contributor who actually worked with him to make that happen. It's pretty cool.
Amazing. Well, that's great. I appreciate your time, my friend. It's been a true pleasure. And any last words?
I would say this year is pretty exciting, as I said, for the reactive space. We try to remove the last barrier people have in migrating to reactive stuff, which is the access to relational database. That's mostly why a lot of people have not been able to adopt reactive stuff. That's because they use SQL, and we don't have any answer to that. And we are going to provide, and you should check out r2dbc.io. We are going to provide a bunch of things there, so people now can use reactive stuff even if they access a relational database. I will check out Spring 1, because we're going to have a lot of talks about these things as well. Spring 1 in Austin, early October. I think there is a site for that. I will probably tweet that in a short moment. And so check this out. Check rsocket.io as well. It's mind-blowing in general. I mean, it makes you rethink all you know about application communications and how to application communicate to between each other. It's pretty interesting. All this, I feel like it's the sum of a lot of smart people who kept thinking for about that for years, including Todd Montgomery as well, and you know Ben Christensen and Steve Gurry and Robert Russell from Netlify as well, and Ryan. It's awesome. Even if you don't adopt it, it will be just inspiring. All this interesting stuff you will find. Not getting into the details, but check it out, rsocket.io.
I remember those two topics were very successful in the the last Spring One platform conference edition that we had. So
yeah, that was the first time we introduced that. So it was pretty forward-looking, but this year we expect to see a more interesting sample applications. You know, that's a classic evolution. You know, we matured this thing.
All right, thank you, my friend. Been a pleasure, and of course, to everybody listening, we'll all see you next time.
Thank you, Josh.
A Bootiful Podcast was produced by me, Josh Long. Music for this episode was sampled from Steve Combs' theme from A Morning in Springtime and Steve Combs' Small Victory, both licensed under the Creative Commons license. No harm came to any seasons in the making of this podcast. I do these podcasts because I believe that everything we do in software is for and made better by people. I want to hear from you. I'm Josh at joshlong.com by email or at StarbucksMan, StarbucksMan on Twitter, where my DMs are wide open. Have guest ideas, topic suggestions? Don't hesitate to reach out. As always, Spring fans, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.